Today's closing speaker, Tom Mullen. Tom got his PhD from Edinburgh and spent many years at Oxford University. And about 10 years ago, he moved, appropriately enough, to Reynolds' hometown of the University of Manchester, where he is now the director of the Manchester Center for Nonlinear Dynamics. And he's going to tell us about a good old pal of Pipe Club.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the introduction, Stephen. It's a great pleasure to be here, and thanks to Stephen for inviting me here and sending me off on this interesting tour around southern Ontario in the last week. But anyway, today I'm going to tell you about what I've called the enigma of the transition to turbulence in a pipe. The reason I've called it an enigma is that it's a very old problem, as I will describe. It's been around for 125 years or so since Reynolds did his work. And mathematically, the problem should be stable in that all pipe flows that we have in the kitchen sink or in the central heating system, whatever, the flows should all be laminar according to mathematical analysis, but we all know that flows generally are turbulent in pipes. And so it's an enigma because on one time theory tells you one thing, but practice tells you something else. And no one really understands why this is the case. 5 years ago, I was given a special fellowship to carry out an experimental investigation of this problem. And of course, as you do when you write out a case for support, I told them that I would solve this problem. My fellowship finishes in September, so I still have a little while left. So this is joint work by a series of, both by myself and series of postdocs. Principally, I'll talk about recent work towards the end by a postdoc of mine called George Pixino, who's now in Japan. Alan Derbyshire, Bjorn Hopf, and Anne Jewell. And this work is, and my fellowship is supported by the EPSRC, which is our National Funding Council. So I want to tell you a little bit, first of all, about the motivation for this problem. It's of scientific interest because, as I said, all theory suggests that laminar flow should be the norm. But in practice, most pipe flows are turbulent, even at modest flow rates. Generally speaking, pipe flows in oil pipelines and so on typically are turbulent flows. It would be, so scientifically, it's of great interest because no one knows why, where this turbulence comes from, how it arises. It's not like the sorts of problems that Stephen studies in where you in convection and so on, where you have a sequence of instabilities, or indeed I've done that sort of work also. It's something that just happens suddenly and for reasons that no one really knows why. It's of practical interest because if you could maintain laminar flows to practical flow rates, then the energy budget would be a tremendous energy saving because typically, or for reasonable flow rates, it might need an order of magnitude increase in pressure gradient to drive that flow for a turbulent flow over a laminar flow. So there'd be a tremendous energy saving. It's a difficult problem. Many people have had a go at this problem, including Heisenberg for his diploma thesis, looked at pipe flow, and then went off to do some more important things, perhaps, but it clearly is a problem that annoyed him because he returned to turbulence when he was incarcerated in Cambridge towards the end of the Second World War, where he's under house arrest. So it's a problem that's been around for a long time. Lots of people have had a go at it, 125 years or so. The equations of motion have been known for an even longer time, so you might say, well, where's the physics in this? Because the equations have been known for a very long time. Surely it's a matter of just putting these on a computer and solving them. Well, unfortunately, that is not possible even today to just simply do that. There are some approximations one can do and so on and so forth, but doing the full problem is really very difficult, and sometimes it's difficult to know what you will get out of just directly putting things on a computer in this case. So what I've decided to do is to use an experimental physics approach and try to use some ideas from modern theory to try and resolve the issue. And we'll see how far we've managed to get. So as you saw on the poster, this is a sketch from Reynolds' original paper in the Phil Transer Royal Society. He actually only ever published. He published two papers, but it really is just one paper. One was a report on the proceedings of the Royal Society in the same year as this, and the Field Trans contains the full description of his work. It's a very important piece of work when he managed to work out the scaling law for flows in general, which is now called Reynolds scaling, and I will talk some more about that in a minute. The original apparatus still exists in Manchester, and in fact I've used it for undergraduate teaching. It's all completely original, except for the pipe. The original pipe was hand-blown, it was made of lead glass. It still exists, but it's fallen apart. It's been replaced by a plexiglass tube. This is an ebony machined inlet section there, and the way the system works is there's this big tank of water. This is about 2 meters long. This is not to scale. This is about 2 meters long. It's filled with water. It's a brilliant piece of experimental design because the pipe that you're interested in is in the middle of this big bath of water. The water goes into this inlet here. There's a cock there that you open and it lets the flow go out there. So the pipe is sitting in a nice temperature-controlled environment because there's lots of thermal inertia in the fluid. It's vibrationally isolated from the outside world. Reynolds really knew what he was doing. It's a wonderful piece of experimental design, and he obtained some fantastic results 125 years ago, and sometimes I think he knew more about the problem than we do know today. I was in Japan recently, and I discovered you can actually buy a replica of this, as you might expect in Japan, but you can buy a replica of this. This costs, I think, equivalent to probably about 5,000 Canadian dollars. You can buy a replica of it. In fact, they had one in Kyoto where I was. It's not particularly good, but it would be actually good for undergraduate experiments and so on. So that's the name of the company, if anybody's interested in looking at their website, and I don't get any commission. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a few facts now about pipe flow. I'm going to talk about fully developed pipe flow, that is when the flow has evolved viscously and it's developed an exact solution of the Navier-Stokes equation, which is just a parabolic profile. It's called quasi-flow, and it's linearly stable. All numerical, analytical, theoretical work suggests that it's linearly stable, but there's not an accepted proof of that, but everybody believes that to be the case. There's a single parameter that governs the equation called the Reynolds number, which is basically a ratio of the inertial to viscous terms, and the kinematic viscosity nu on the bottom there, u is the velocity, d is the diameter of the pipe. That's a single parameter that governs the equation. So when the viscosity is very large, this parameter Reynolds number is very small. The flow is dominated by viscosity and it becomes a linear problem. When the Reynolds number is large, if viscous effects are small, the inertial terms dominate in the Navier-Stokes equations, and then it becomes a nonlinear problem. So this is the definition or a way of thinking about the Reynolds number. When the Reynolds numbers are greater than a couple of thousand, then most pipe flows are turbulent in practice. However, if you're very careful, you can maintain laminar flow up to, or the world record is 100,000, done by a man called Feniger using a wind tunnel type arrangement in the 1960s. Reynolds himself managed to get laminar flow up to Reynolds numbers of about 13,000. So it suggests that there must be a finite amplitude of perturbation you've got to put into the system to cause transition. And if you go below this Reynolds number of 2,000, no matter what you do to the flow, it'll eventually go back to its laminar state. So there's no critical value of the Reynolds number in that if you smoothly increase the Reynolds number, you'd suddenly see the appearance of Reynolds number of 2,000. That's sometimes misleadingly put that way in books, but that's not the case. The 2,000, or I'll say more about that, the 2,000-ish, is the lower bound where turbulent flow can be sustained. And you can get, in practice, you can get laminar flows up to 100,000. And in fact, as we will see later on, there's no reason to suppose why you can't get them to Reynolds number a million if you could possibly design such an experiment. A laminar flow, that is. So in modern theoretical developments, there are many. The best review for anybody who's interested in theoretical developments on this work, then I can highly recommend this review article by someone called Rich Kurzweil. It's in Nonlinearity in 2005, a review article of all the theory up till then. Some of the steps which are important in modern developments is that Frank Smith and one of his students, they showed the existence of a nonlinear, a possibility of a nonlinear neutral solution to the Navier-Stokes equations 20-odd years ago. And this means the possibility, though, although they didn't calculate this, they showed the possibility that there are other states that exist in the problem, which are different from the quasi-flow state. These kinds of states have, in fact, recently been calculated in not the Navier-Stokes equations, but model equations derived from the Navier-Stokes by Kurzweil's group and also Eckhart's group, where they find traveling wave solutions. And these are periodic solutions that are periodic along the pipe, but they have different azimuthal wave numbers. So their pipes are periodic or infinitely long, and they have different wave numbers around. These are numerical solutions in the bottom with these blobs, a cross-section across the pipe, and these blobs represent the different wave numbers along the pipe. These are not states that you can get to by some continuous change in any of the parameters. You've got to get there by some trick or other. And I recommend looking here if you want to know how they do that. So these states are disconnected. They sit out there in solution space, and there are other examples of these in the Navier-Stokes equations which have come, have been discovered in the last 20 or so years. Why they're there, no one really knows, and what role they play in transition and turbulence and so on is still an open question, still a matter for debate. And so recently, an ex-student of mine, Bjorn Hopp, and others in science reported that when they take cross-sectional views using particle image velocimetry techniques, looking at disordered motion in a pipe, then they find structures which are qualitatively the same as the ones that they would get, that you should expect from the theory. These are periodic. In these cases, these are just thin slices through the disordered motion, but it kind of suggests that these finite amplitude or traces of them exist within this disordered motion. So this is at the moment kind of circumstantial evidence, but it suggests that these waves are really rather important. Another idea which has been, which is kind of vogue and an important idea of the last, since about the early 90s, is due to mainly Nick Trevethan and Butler and Farrell and Dan Henningsen, Peter Smith, where they've considered the possibility of, as I said, it's linearly stable, but if you put a perturbation into a small amplitude perturbation into the Navier-Stokes equations, then initially, because of the properties of the equations, so-called non-normal growth, you get an initial algebraic growth of the perturbation to some finite amplitude, and then the nonlinear effects can kick in, and then off you can go to transition. This is so-called transient growth. So initially the infinitesimal perturbation goes algebraically, and then nonlinear effects take over. So these are the kinds of ideas that we might want to explore in some modern experimental investigations, whether any of these are of relevance. So just to go back to Reynolds' experiment for a minute, these pictures were actually taken in the original apparatus, although with the plexiglass tube, and they're in Van Dyck's nice book on flow visualization. When the flow is laminar, there's a die comes in at the entrance along there. When the flow is laminar, the die goes along the middle of the tube and it just stays there. When you go to higher Reynolds numbers above 2,000 or so, and you have a disturbed flow going in at the inlet, you find that you get this disordered motion. There's disorder there because in turbulence, perhaps, because the diffusion of the die is rather rapid, much more rapid than any viscous diffusion. So you see the die diffuses rapidly across the tube. So Reynolds found that if you had disordered flow coming at the inlet, you could find this critical value of a couple of thousand. But in careful experiments, he managed to get up to 13,000 Reynolds number. And what Reynolds described, the turbulence just doesn't come in everywhere in the pipe, and I'll show you examples of this present. It doesn't come in everywhere. It comes in localized patches, which Reynolds describes as flashes, but in more recent work by Wignansky and his group in Arizona, then they describe these as puffs. So there's little blocks of disordered motion. These are interesting things because they're coherent phases which propagate along at 0.9, the mean speed of the flow. And they don't change their form. If you go to higher Reynolds numbers, you get the formation of slugs, which are regions of disordered motion which spread as they propagate along. And I'll show you now some examples of both of those. So at the top here, I have a video. We use laser Doppler techniques and particle image velocimetry techniques and so on and so forth, but I'm going to concentrate on showing you full visualization images today to give you an idea, a more visual idea of what is going on in the pipe. So there's a flow going along there. So there's a laminar state with some disordered flow coming in. There's a weak, wavy structure comes in here. The flow becomes highly disordered as this is a puff, and then it shuts down rapidly at the tail end. So if I run it just one more time. And these paths are about 20 pipe diameters long, and as I say, they propagate at about 0.9, the mean speed of the flow. So the initial profile you started with is a parabolic profile. If you measure the flow in these puff regions along the central axis, the flow is laminar here, you get a weak wave that comes along here, rapid high distortion here, and then a rapid collapse back to laminar state. They travel at 0.9, the mean speed of the flow, which means that the mean speed passes through the puff. So I think is that the mean flow goes in, gets highly disordered within the path, it goes into this high-dimensional mess, and then it gets spat out the front end. And as it gets spat out, it's unable to sustain itself, and it decays away. So that, and they maintain their form of 20 diameters long and travel at 0.9, the mean speed. If you go to higher Reynolds numbers now, then they go to about 4,000, then you get into this regime where there are slugs present. So if we leave the flow alone, nothing will happen. If you inject a disturbance into the flow, as we will do presently, then you get the formation of a rapid mess rather quickly. Now you see immediately there's also a sharp tail on it, but you can see from that structure there's lots of small scale present. In the puff regime, there are lots of bigger scales present, and therefore it's not really proper turbulence in the sense that if you look at the spectral evidence, it's not fully turbulent. But in this case, we're getting closer to what is more like really turbulent flow. And in this case, the head travels faster than the mean flow, the tail travels slower, and so it spreads as it propagates. So if you had a very, very long pipe, it eventually filled the whole pipe. And if you go to Reynolds number, so this is the structure is more sharp at the front and the tail. The structure and the mean flow structure inside is more blunted, like you'd find in turbulent pipe flows. If you go to even higher speeds, the Reynolds number 10,000. If you leave it alone, nothing will happen. If you inject a disturbance into the flow, then you get the rapid creation of this disordered mess. And now you have what people have measured, lots of statistics and so on of such flows, and now there is more like a proper turbulent flow. So that's a rough classification of the kinds of things that you see over a range of Reynolds numbers in this problem. So when you, as I mentioned at the beginning, one of the reasons for there might be some technological interest in this is that the pressure gradient required to drive a flow goes up significantly when you have turbulent over laminar flow. So what I decided to do was to do the experiment in a different way. That is not because how would you do an experiment? You'd have a big tank of fluid here, you have a very long pipe, you have a tap at the other end, you'd open it up and so on. And that's then driven by a pressure gradient. But what I decided to do was basically build the world's biggest syringe. This is a piston here with a inner diameter there, which is slightly smaller than the outer, and it pulls the water along the tube. So this is the end of my syringe. This is my needle, which is 17 meters long. It's 2 centimeters in diameter, and it's 17 meters long. How do you make such a long, straight pipe and be able to see through it? Well, as you've probably seen in all the videos that I've shown thus far, there are lots of sections about that length. Each one of those has been machined from solid plexiglass. They've all been push-fitted together. They've all been honed out on the joints so that there's no interference from the joints because we can run this flow the fastest we can run it. Laminar is Reynolds number 23,000. That just happens to be the fastest we can run this piston. And to let you know how the quality of the technical work that's done on this, there are no leaks and there is no glue in there. That's quite an achievement to me, I tell you too. It took us about 3 years to get this to work. It was a major undertaking to get it to work. That's what it looks like in practice. We have a camera track which follows these things along. You'll see some videos of the camera going along. The piston is in there. This is the pipe. And it's all in a temperature-controlled environment because, as you will see later on, that we have to have very accurate control in the Reynolds numbers in order to get some fundamentally new quantities out of this experiment. So that's the experiment. So now I just fix by pulling the piston at a well-defined rate, I'm fixing the Reynolds number in the problem by allowing the pressure to do what it wants to do. And I believe in Reynolds. Reynolds says, well, the dynamical parameters, Reynolds number. So if we keep that fixed, then we're in pretty good shape, I hope. How do you perturb the flow? Now, mathematically, of course, you put in an AE to the I omega T, and then you look to see whether it grows or not. Of course, in an experiment, you can't do that. Because if you start, this is a finite amplitude perturbation problem, so if I start putting a periodic oscillation in there, I'm starting to drive the flow and so on periodically, and so that's not necessarily a good thing to do. Although some people have done that. What we do is we essentially look at the response of the system to an impulsive perturbation. And we do that using, this is a motor car fuel injection system here, and we inject boxcars of fluid, or we can take boxcar of fluid out, or we can do both simultaneously and inject zero net mass flux into the problem. And this, it turns out, is a very neat way of doing things because it allows us to separate out the amplitude and the time scale. The amplitude is just the ratio of the amount of mass flux we inject over that of the pipe, and this is typically less than 1%. And the length scale, which is the crucial parameter, is the mean speed times the time for which we inject divided by the diameter. So it tells us this time in diameters. And to show you why that is important, if you take velocity time traces about two pipe diameters downstream from where you inject the fluid or inject and pull out the fluid, then these are 40 different runs of the experiment. With superimposed velocity time traces. And what I was interested in here was to know which part of the perturbation is important in causing transition. So I looked at these and couldn't see what was important or what was not. Because if you look at these, you would think, well, these seem to have be greater area underneath. These seem to be of greater amplitude. These will be the ones that will cause transition. This is what you would think naturally looking at it. But actually, it's these perturbations here that produce the transition downstream. It's not at all obvious what is causing the transition, but this gave us an important clue. It's this length scale here that's important. What this seems to be doing at these Reynolds numbers is because the path or the region of localized disordered motion is of the order of 20 diameters by the time you take all the wiggle into account, but the middle part is the order of 9 or 10 diameters. If you hit that with the appropriate length scale, which is what this is, then it receives that rather well. It's a receptivity type problem. So that's why separating out the length scale and the time scale in this way is important. And we do various things. We inject near walls. We inject straight across the flow. We inject azimuthally to inject swirl into the flow and so on and so forth. And I'll say more about that presently. So what did we find? What we found a number of years ago was, about 3 or 4 years ago, that this is a plot of the amplitude of the perturbation, assuming we've satisfied this criterion of the length, as a function of the Reynolds number. And so if we inject perturbations in this region and here, they will all decay. If we go above this line here, they will all become turbulent. But turbulent in a sense that some of them will turn into puffs, some of them will turn into slugs, and some of them will turn into fully disordered motion down here. And I should point out there are 8 points, you would think, on that graph. But actually, there are 320 points, on at least 320 points in that graph, because this is a probabilistic transition. And if I tell you, you can get 2 data points per day on this, because you need to wait a long time for the experiment to settle down and so on, you realize there's a huge amount of effort has gone into producing this data set. So this is a kind of threshold curve where you reach this threshold and then you jump over. Let me show you what I mean by that. So this is just below that curve at Reynolds number 2000. You inject some kind of perturbation. We're now following it. You see it tries to turn into a disordered state, but it fails and it disappears some distance downstream. If we go just above the curve, above the line, and inject a perturbation, then you see it rapidly turns into, that's why I was saying about the 2 pipe diameters, it rapidly turns into one of the turbulent puffs. So that's just below and just above the line. And what this shows rather nicely, and we were quite pleased about this, is that it shows a scaling between the amplitude of perturbation required to cause transition versus the Reynolds number. And it shows a simple 1 over Reynolds number scaling. So as I've pointed out, the Reynolds number is a balance between viscous and inertia terms in the Navier-Stokes equations, and so it's just saying that there's this simple balance works between viscous and inertia in the equations of motion. So lots of people got excited about this, but I didn't think it was, if you think a bit further, it's not particularly exciting. It was okay to find a scaling law and systematic behavior, but there are some question marks that it raises. One is, what happens below Reynolds number of the order of a couple of thousand? Because I've already pointed out to you, no matter what you do to the flow at these small Reynolds numbers, it will always remain laminar, because all previous experimental work suggested that the flow is globally stable for Reynolds number smaller than a couple of thousand. So Reynolds number -1 can no longer hold. So what we could do is perhaps add a large perturbation to the problem and observe the decay, find out whether any old perturbation we put in, see how long it survived and so on. But doing that experimentally is actually not a very sensible idea, because it not only introduces disturbances into the flow field, it also distorts the mean flow. And so you can get long-term transient behavior, which is not very useful. So what we decided to do was to do the experiment in the reverse way. Because, as I said, I have this big piston that pulls the water along the pipe, so not only can I fix the Reynolds number at a particular value, but I can also change the Reynolds number to any particular value that I would like. The direct transition is catastrophic, but perhaps if we go from turbulence to the laminar state, I might be able to find an occasion where I go back through a more interesting way back to laminar flow, where I might be able to pick up some coherence in the steps back down. This idea had been tried previously by these people here, but in their cases, they introduced a change in Reynolds number locally by making the pipe diverge. But in my case, I'm slowing down the flow everywhere by the time I slow down my piston. So what I do is I create a puff in the system at a given Reynolds number. I let it equilibrate. I have a nice, well-defined, natural state of the system. And then I slow the whole thing down by reducing to a final Reynolds number. And I look to the evolution of that disordered state. I test the stability, if you like, of that disordered state. That's the basic idea. So we have this unique facility to be able to do this, and so what I'm going to show you is happens. So here we are at a Reynolds number 1900. We've injected the perturbation. We let it go for 100 pipe diameters, and then it evolves into one of these puffs. You can see more of the puff now with its weak, wavy front, its sharp tail, and so on. And it will evolve along for 100 pipe diameters or so. And then we reach some state, we now reduce the Reynolds number to 1500, and it won't survive. And so when it gets down to here, It's going to decay, and the interest now is how does it decay, over what time scale does it decay, and what's the process on the way back? Is it going through some nice wave state on the way back down? Because as I pointed out to the way up, it's like switching on a laser or switching on a light. It's just a sudden catastrophic change, but here you hope that it goes down through some stages. And in particular, if these periodic states, if these finite amplitude states exist, perhaps it visit these on the way down. That was the idea. So, these are the results obtained from a whole set of experiments which appeared in Physical Review last year, when what these are plots of is the probability of observing one of these disordered states as a function of the distance downstream. So it's a distance downstream here, the probability of observing one. So at zero corresponds to the region at where I initiate the disturbed flow. I then let it evolve for 100 pipe diameters to here, and then I switch down the Reynolds number in a finite time. I can't do it in zero time. I switch it down in a small time, and we check the dependence of that. It doesn't depend very much over the range we looked. And if I go down to, say, this one here, which is the Reynolds number of 1580, then what happens is it will decay. And this is, so these, this time, this distance here, there's only 10% probability of observing any one of these puffs. By the time you get down here, there's essentially all disappeared. These are exponential decays. These lines fitted are exponentials. These are log-log plots. Sorry, there's log linear plots, and this is a fit of exponentials. And you can see that as we go to higher and higher final Reynolds numbers, so it takes longer and longer time for these puffs to decay. I should say each one of these runs, the black, the red, the green, and so on, each requires 40 to 50 runs of the experiment in order to get good statistics on these. And so as we go to higher and higher final states of the Reynolds number, then you find that there's a longer and longer time taking place. And because this is an exponential, then you can extract a time scale from it, or a half-life from the decay. And if you extract a half-life from it, what you find is that there's a divergence in the time scales as you approach a finite value of the Reynolds number. And you get it can establish from that there's a critical value of the Reynolds number, 1750, plus or minus 10, which are our genuine estimates of the error bars on this, below which the turbulence will not survive, or above which the turbulence, or the puff in this case, will survive forever. And forever in our case is along the length of our pipe. We clearly are towards the end of the pipe by the time we get here, but the important thing is that the scaling works all the way up here. Does this work in any other way? Well, you might say, well, this is one experiment, and it may not be applicable in other situations. So some colleagues in Rich Kerswell's group in Bristol, what they did was they carried out a numerical simulation of this problem. And this is a really tough numerical challenge because your numerical pipe has to be long enough to accommodate one of these structures within it. In this case, it has to be at least 50. In this case, it's 50 pipe diameters long. And then you have to do your calculations, highly resolved calculations on to resolve all these scales and so on in there. So it's a big numerical challenge to do it. It's always a numerical challenge for my computer. Here we go. So there's it will come in a minute. Sorry, the top one will come. And they should come roughly together. Okay, so there's the puff in the experiment, and there is the puff in the numerics, just to show you that they look real. They've got the wave structure ahead of them as before. They've got this arrowhead tail, which has got an arrowhead thing there. It's got highly disordered motion somewhere in between. And so these are, as I said, they're quite tough numerical challenges to do it, but in this case, you know, we're just moving things at the speed of the puff in each of these cases, so those appear to be standing still in the top one. So just to show you that they are numerically resolved, and we quite believe the results that they are getting. But now they've obtained this structure within their calculations, they now have the possibility of doing the same as we do in our experiments, that is, changing the Reynolds number in their problem, just by reducing the Reynolds number in the numerical simulation and doing what we did in our experiment. And if they do that, and they have some numerical noise in here and so on, so there's probabilistic things just as we have in our experiments, and they also find exponential decays, as we did, and they can estimate half-lives, and they find a divergence of timescales, as we did in our experiments, and this, it's actually wrong, it appeared in they hoped it was going to be 2006, it appeared in the first week of, in PRL in the first week of 2007. Anyway, it's they find a divergence of timescales as we did in our experiments. And this is a comparison between the experimental data, which is in blue, and the numerical data, which is in red. So this is a plot that shows the divergence of the timescales as we had before, or plotted in this way, the 1 over t way there, and you can see that there's a critical point that's reached. And you can see that there's a difference between the two. But I have to say that obtaining this kind of agreement between the numerics and experiments for this open flow system is really quite a remarkable achievement on the numerical part to get as close as this, because it's subject to, they have a periodic box of 50 pipe diameters long and so on and so forth. We have all sorts of different conditions in our experiment. And so to get this close between numerics and experiments, I think is really quite remarkable in for the numerical simulations to get as close as this. So we're really, and qualitatively, of course, it's the same as we have in our experiments. So it really is rather satisfying. So what this does, you see, it sets a definite hard lower bound below which these disordered states can exist or not. Because the exponential decay suggests, in the probability of observing the puff downstream, suggests that there's a Poisson process going on here. It's a random process, and it's got some decay associated with it. But the divergence of timescales suggests that there's a deterministic part behind all of this. What it is yet, we don't quite know. These ideas have been well looked at in low-dimensional systems and low-dimensional dynamics and chaos. If you have some three-dimensional system which has a chaotic attractor associated with it, and then you change a parameter, then the chaotic attractor changes the parameter back down towards the linear regime, then the chaotic attractor may disappear, in which case it will reach what's called a boundary basin crisis. And there are well-established rules for the way that goes. But low-dimensional systems typically have exponents less than 1. We seem to find an exponent which is identically 1 for our divergence. And this kind of suggests to me that there must be some kind of critical point sitting there in phase space. But as yet, we've been unable to identify that. But the thing I really was interested in was to see whether, as I said, the switch upwards to go from the laminar flow state to the turbulent state was like switching a laser, whatever. It suddenly went from one state to another, and it was very difficult, despite lots of attempts to try and look at the details of what was involved in the transition process. It was so sharp, it was very difficult to decide what it was going on. But when we came back down again, we found some evidence for these traveling wave states. They've got to be locally, they're not obviously going to be periodic along the whole length of the pipe, but they do have, if you measure the velocity in the center of the flow, a transverse velocity in the center of the flow, they do have this coherent structure which is of the wavelength which is coincident with the kind of traveling waves that have been found in their numerical models. So there's some evidence that in this relaminarization process, just as I described, a puff, it's a highly disordered state, which then relaminarizes, it comes down, it sort of bounces its way back down past these traveling wave states as it comes back down towards the laminar flow state. And perhaps that's what the disordered motion is. It's just like on a pinball machine or something, when you let the ball go and it bounces around all these nails, then that's really what this disordered motion is about, is you've got all these finite states and it's just bouncing around in some erratic way. And each of the states has got several degrees of freedom of its own, so it becomes a highly apparently disordered, completely disordered motion. That's the kind of idea. So just to finish with some much more recent work, although this is just in the process of going for publication. I've been wondering for a period of time whether we're perturbing this flow in the optimal way or not. And I've had lots, I mean, whenever you set up one of these kinds of experiments, you're talking about doing something for a couple of years or something. So it's a big investment to change things around. And so after lots of discussion with Dan Henningsen and Herman Fassel, they persuaded me that perhaps there was a better way of perturbing the flow other than the way we were doing by injecting across the flow in 6 weeks azimuthally. And they suggested actually a variance on one of these where you created these little vortices at the walls with different symmetries, and we had lots of arguments about symmetries and not. But it turned out the optimal way to do it was just to inject and push and pull on one side of the tube and just produce a little vortex locally there. And this is essentially the threshold curve in length here as a function of amplitude. And so if we cross this boundary here, you see this is much lower than doing it with the four up here. One is much more efficient than four. So this new type of disturbance, this was our old results for a single jet or multiple jets and so on. We did this in many different ways to get this Reynolds number minus one. But now doing it in this new way, then what we find, first of all, is that there's an order of magnitude reduction in the threshold amplitude required to cause transition, so it's a much more sensitive way of doing the experiment. We've also got zero net mass flux going in, which is rather nice. We can also get this with zero net mass flux, but in a different way. But doing this local perturbation like this produced this really rather nice result, because now we feel much more like we're perturbing the flow rather than pushing something horrible in. But the other interesting thing is that the slope of the line is now minus 1.3. Why should we get excited about that? Because, as I said, the Reynolds number is a ratio between viscous and inertial terms. Because it's minus 1.3, what it's telling you is that the viscous terms and the inertial terms were in balance. Just means that the viscosity kills things off at the same time as that nonlinearity is trying to make them grow. But if it's minus 1.3, it tells you that there's time for evolution of something else in due to the nonlinear terms. And minus 1.3. Or minus anything other than minus one is, or greater than minus one is a helpful thing for the creation of some more interesting things. So, to give you an idea yet again of what happens with the, a single jet, I've shown you this before, when you inject, it looks as if we're doing something horrible to that, but I can assure you we're injecting less than 1% into there. And yet you see the creation of this thing that happens rather quickly, and this is my on-off switch that we had before. But now when we look at this more sensitive way of doing things, I'll wait for that thing to stop. If I do it now with this more sensitive way of doing things, you see all that nice periodic structure that comes out. That's really rather exciting because it tells you, I mean, if you've just got something that just goes bang, there's not very much you can say about it. Eventually, of course, it ends up where we were before, but the fact that it's got this periodicity there means you can perhaps do something with it. You can perhaps do some analysis and so on, and this is the stage we're at the moment. If you take some stills from this, if you look on the side, then you get these nice periodic structures that appear. You see them there. If you look from the bottom, they're horseshoes. And horseshoes are well known to play a role in transition in boundary layers and other sorts of flows. And this is the first time that I think that they've been seen explicitly like this in this pipe flow problem. So by changing around this perturbation, it now suggests a new way forward in the way that we might be able to analyze this system and look for the transition process. And more important than that, perhaps, it suggests also that if you can put these sorts of things into a flow in some deliberate way, provides a mechanism in which you might be able to control the flow. People have done that in boundary layers and so on. So it suggests a way that you might be able to control flow in a practical way, not in a my physicist sort of way. So my view now of what this problem is that we have this laminar state which will exist for all Reynolds numbers. We have some boundary which scales as 1 over Reynolds number, 1 over Reynolds number to 1.3. So if we stay down here, we're okay. And so as I said, you can go up to whatever, in principle, you could go up to any Reynolds number you want, as long as you can control all the background disturbances and so on. You could extend this out further. Above it, there is this turbulent state with this laminar and, this puffs and slugs and so on, and this disorder state. In here, embedded in here, theoretically, we know that there are all these finite amplitude states in periodic models, at least, of this. And they all will exist down to Reynolds numbers, and now actually lower than that, a Reynolds number about 1100. You get all these states here. And then there's this wall that divides, this is where my critical point is, between the turbulent state and these decaying states. And so the way that the decay takes place is it bounces around, as I say, down via these periodic states on its way back down to the laminar state. And so perhaps this disordered motion is this thing randomly jumping around between on this pinball machine. So I just finish with a few conclusions that I think these scaling laws are really now quite well established for this transition to turbulence and a pipe. Other people have now measured some and so on. The minus one exponent is tells us that there's a balance between viscous and inertial terms, but the minus 1.3 I think is perhaps more exciting because it tells you about the possibility of transient growth, of this business of things growing up and going through the sequential stages and then taking off. And there's real possibilities of developing this, either in terms of it gaining more insight into transition itself or, as I mentioned, into control. And this slowing down suggests that there may be critical behaviour in there. For an open flow system, this is really quite bizarre, and I'm not quite sure I understand this completely yet. And the waves suggest that these finite amplitude solutions are there, they play a role, and they are rather important. Thank you for your attention. Yes, well, you know, in the optimal growth thing, of transient growth, the wavelength you want to put in is infinitely long. We have two little holes here, and what we believe we're doing is we're creating a little vortex like that. And it's known in these transient growth ideas and so on, you get these long streaks and so on, and then they promote roles and so on, and you have this self-sustaining process of Fabian-Maleff. And what we would like to think is we are creating these roles that go along like that, and they're advected along, and then we initiate the process in that way. That's what we'd like to think. What I would like to dearly like, I mean, these results are literally a few months old. What I'd really like to do now is to do some more quantitative, not flow visualization, quantitative things like PIV and so on to look into that. And as I indicated, the interest in that is that there's a really nice paper in PRL last year which showed that in a boundary layer, if you created a flow with rolls, it would actually be more stable than a flow without rolls. There's a paper by Michael Franson from KTH in Stockholm, which means that in the pipe flow problem, it may be possible to, that if this mechanism is really, is as I imagine it, it may be possible to control this problem. And the most dangerous part of a pipe flow is the inlet. If in my experiment, if I tap my finger on the surface of the water in the tank, it will go at any Reynolds, if you go above Reynolds number 3 or 4,000, it will just go if you tap your finger on it. But if you go downstream, you've got to hit it before it will go. So quasi flow is much more stable than inlet flow. So if you could put these kinds of structures in at the inlet in a mechanical way, just by having a periodic, you know, thing round the inlet of the pipe, you may well control the inlet of the flow. And that's by far the most interesting thing practically, if you could control it without putting some movable thing or whatever, just put a fixed thing in there. And I think that would be really rather interesting if it were to work. But that's why these things, that's what this is suggesting. Yes. Is there a? Well, I believe in the no-slip boundary condition for this problem. I mean, the calculations are carried out, of course, with no-slip boundary conditions imposed. I don't see any evidence. Why would you think there'd be any? I mean, this is a macroscopic phenomenon, so I'm not sure. I mean, what you might be worried about is roughness at the surfaces and so on. That. Oh, sorry, the trumpet at the inlet. You mean at the very inlet, this thing here? This. Ah, well, the reason, this was a clever design by Reynolds. What it does, I mean, when the flow comes in like this, it comes in flat, okay, at the entrance there. The viscous boundary layers have got to grow on there. And because he's designed it, if it's too steep a curvature, you've got separation, and if that's what you mean, you'll get separation. But Reynolds designed this rather cleverly. It's actually nearly a hyperbolic tangent. What this does is actually accelerate the viscous growth. And by the time, you don't actually need so many pipe diameters downstream in practice in order to get positive flow with that design. So that was another bit of clever design by Reynolds. But of course, if you have that too steep, because, you know, if you put, say, just at my inlet, if I just have a pipe like that, then what I'm going to do is get some disturbances created by there. So that's a practical way. But Reynolds was more clever than just taking that away. He actually designed that so it would accelerate the viscous growth. No, this is made of ebony. It's machined out of ebony, and it's still the same one that's in the tank. No, the glass blower didn't have to make it. I mean, no, I know. It's made of ebony, and there are actually some other hardwood ones there also lying in the case. And actually, when you look at Reynolds' pipe, it's got waves in it, because it was hand-blown, his pipe. It's got waves in it. So how he managed to get to Reynolds number 13,000, I think it's quite remarkable. But I think it's because, as I said earlier, the most dangerous part is here. And if you can control that, which is what he did rather cleverly, then the waves and so on in the pipe down here don't matter so much. I think that was clever in his design.
I read a paper about 30 years ago where they used the flows where they had laminar flow up to Reynolds number bigger than 200,000.
Well, I can't find a reference to this paper. If you could give me a I'm writing a review on it. And it's supposedly done it from a lake. Is this the paper you're talking about, when it's from a lake and then they Yeah, okay.
Now, in your experiment, you can do it as push or pull mode.
Yes.
And I'm sure the two ends are not identical.
They are. We did that.
Is there a difference?
No. Well, I do it in a pull mode because you can do it in both ways. But I do it in a pull mode because, you know, you're pulling from a still tank of water. Okay. When you're doing it in a push mode, then you know, the end... Oh, I'm running out of board here. Is there a duster in this place? Ah, right. No, I'll answer over there because he's... So at the other end of my pipe, I have that essentially and then goes into my piston like that. And so when I push back, in principle, it's the same way around. But I don't like... I mean, that... Pardon? It's not exactly the same. It is supposed to be. I just drew it... Sorry, I'm not very good at... Undergraduates always complaining about my drawing. Anyway, it's that way around, and we made it mirror image to try and overcome that. But I really don't like pushing things in that way, because this thing is driven on a lead screw, a very nice lead screw, which we got specially made in Germany, which pull things around. But the trouble is also that there are piston, which is made, is ground inside, and it's 30 centimetres in diameter. Like anything that's machined, it's got a very small taper on it, an incredibly small 50th of a millimetre taper from one end to the other. So pushing and pulling are actually not equivalent in our system. But if you knew this reference, I'd love to have it, because I'm writing this review, and several people have told me about this, but I don't know where it is. And I've been told it was a lake somewhere in Colorado that the... But I'd love to know the reference to it, because it's... As far as I know, and I often see quoted this 100,000 of Finnegan, I've got a copy of his paper, which is in an obscure conference, but I don't know this other one.
Yeah.
Yeah. The water hammer, it's called.
And not water hammer, but
singing. Oh, singing.
Singing.
Ooh.
I'm just wondering, sometimes I've seen sinusoidal stuff that comes up and looks like a primary vortex, but it's just in a pipe with no little cylinder. I'm just wondering if you could.
Well, in fact, one way that, I mean, that people have, as I said, I'm writing this review and there's some hundreds of studies of this pipe flow problem. And one thing that people do at entrance lengths is actually to put a small cylinder there and then look at the Karman vortex tree as the way that they induce transition in this problem. Now, one thing I don't like about doing that sort of thing is that once the flow, this is a permanent perturbation that's in there. Once the flow begins to go, you reach a significant amplitude and so on, once it starts to go down here, this is still being forced by that. So it's on a changing background. So that's why the reason why I don't use that sort of thing. But some other people, there's a 160-something page paper by a man called Lindgren in the 1950s, then you could publish papers like that in the Physics for Archive, about this. And he did exactly that. He put this small thing into the flow and then observed the Karman vortex tree and its effects on transition. So the man's name is called Lindgren. He's actually very much alive and lives in he's Swedish, but he lives in Florida. So if you want to look him up, you'll find